If you could have a conversation with anyone in history, what would you ask them?
Hello, General Washington. Good day, Miss Tubman.
I had to know, so I decided, let's give him a call.
Welcome to the Calling History Podcast.
I'm Tony Dean, and today we'll be calling history to speak with Mercy Otis Warren. She'll be answering our call on February 19th, 1774, at the age of 45. At this time in history, the city of Boston is on edge, waiting for the English response to the Boston Tea Party that happened 2 months prior. Rabble-rousers like Samuel Adams and powerful men that we now call founding fathers have become tired of Parliament, their taxes, and their never-ending assault on liberty. The whole area is a powder keg, and a slow-burning fuse has already been lit. In the middle of the chaos was the Warren home that served as a meeting place for the Sons of Liberty and those that would later fuel the American Revolution. Her husband, James, was a strong advocate for liberty, but at this time, a woman's place was in the home, not in politics. Yet, Mercy was educated, a prolific writer, and a poet with ideas to further the cause of freedom. As a woman, though, she was first committed to her children, her husband, and her God. If she were to address the problem as men did, by pounding their fists, Mercy could have ruined her family's reputation. So instead, she used her powerful words to assault these injustices by anonymously writing poems and eventually a play called The Adulator. Key members of English government were written into the play as characters, but with different names. Once it was published in the newspaper, it was well received, and in a way functioned as a code, allowing citizens to discuss their grievances without having to do it openly and risk their own freedom. It took tremendous courage to express herself at this time when it was not acceptable to do so. Yet the world would be a very different place if those that could do good had waited until they were allowed to. Ladies and gentlemen, fellow history lovers, and everyone who loves the smell of a good book, I give you Mercy Otis Warren.
Hello, is that you, Mrs. Warren?
Sir, I can hear the voice of the speaker, but I know not where the sound comes from. Do you care to show yourself?
I won't be able to show myself, unfortunately, but I will introduce myself. My name's Tony Dean, and I'm talking to you actually from the future in the 21st century. That device in front of you, that's where the sound's coming from. And what that is, it's called a smartphone. It allows us to speak as if we were sitting in the same room, just face-to-face talking with one another. And it also allows me to share a record of our conversation with people around the world. And I was hoping that I could ask you some questions today, but before I do, I understand this is a strange introduction. Can I answer any questions, any other questions that you might have first?
Oh, good day to you, Mr. Dean. I trust that you're well. I must admit that this method of correspondence is a little disorienting, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
If we were writing a correspondence, you see, you could not see my face and I would be unable to see yours. However, we may hold a discussion as if you were right in front of me. And this is essentially what is happening now, is it not?
That is correct. In our time, we can do this from anywhere. And so you can have a person that's 100 miles from you and just have a conversation like this, like they were right there. And then you could stop and have a conversation with somebody that's across the world in the same way.
That is remarkable. I must admit, oftentimes in my correspondence, I wish I would be able to hear the voice of my beloved family member or my dear friend. So this is quite remarkable.
Try to imagine in your time with all this wonderful work that you have written, and try to imagine in your time that you were able to write that. And instead of having to go through the process of printing it, you could send it to every person in the entire world in the same day. I mean, that's what the future looks like. Now, you can't tell anybody this. It's a secret. They got to find out on their own.
No.
But that sounds amazing, doesn't it?
No, Mr. Dean, you're referencing my writings. You have read my personal correspondence?
I have read some of what you've written and developed an understanding of what you were trying to accomplish, because right now you're living in very difficult times, aren't you?
It is very troubling. I have to have your assurance that no one from my time will know of this conversation?
Yes, that is correct. We're hundreds of years down the road. And so people are going to be able to read the things that you have written. The history is well documented. We already know what happens next. The reason that I'm calling you is not to find any secrets, but really just to get your perspective on what happened, what you are trying to accomplish. You're a hero in our time. You're a person that women look up to. They look up to you and they say, if I could find the courage to be like that, I could make a difference. And so your enemies will never hear this, and nobody in your time will hear this, but the people that will hear this are the people that are looking for inspiration, because they see what you did and said, maybe I could be better than I am.
Sure, that gives me great comfort. It is very important to Mr. Warren and myself and my friends and my family and the safety of all involved that my name is not put to these works that you're referencing from. Mr. Dean, if I could please perhaps ask you a question that might be a little self-indulgent. You mentioned my writing, but those in my inner circle and my friends and my companions know that my poetry is the work that I have been putting my name to. However, how should I say, more delicate works of a political nature, I am not yet allowing my name to be associated with. Is it possible by your time in the future, people do know it is my hand that has written these political works?
Absolutely. I know that it is not common in your time for women to assign their name to something, especially that would be controversial. And yes, the things that you have written now that have to do with the possibility of some sort of revolution or standing up against what England is doing. Yes, we absolutely know about those works. In fact, there have been some works in our time that have been attributed to you that the scholars have looked back and said, no, that wasn't her, because she'd never say that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think people are pretty clear on what you've written and what you have not.
That is remarkable. Is it possible that in the future, women are printing and publishing under their own name?
It is possible. In fact, it is happening for sure. In fact, not only are women publishing and doing all those things, women run businesses. Women hold the same positions as men. We were very close to having a woman president. And in other countries around the world, there have been women that have been president and are right now. So yes, women play a different role, partially because of some of the things that you've done. In our time, it's hard to even imagine the challenges you would have had, because you couldn't just go out and publish something in your name. I'm guessing there would be some repercussion. What would happen if you were to write something against England in your name and they found out it was you? What would the consequences be?
There are laws and protections for the press. One might hearken back to the Zenger trial in New York City in the 1730s. However, you must remember that women's sphere is one not to be found in politics. It is the duty of the woman to run the household, to be a dutiful wife and mother. And I can't imagine the damage that could be caused if it was found that a woman was making her voices known in a political realm. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, but it's very confusing, because it appears that's exactly what you did. You were trying to juggle both of those, weren't you?
My role, first and foremost, is to be a wife and a mother. I have had the incredible good fortune of having an education and taking up a more masculine approach to my thoughts because of the men who have championed education around me. I frequently struggle with my role as a writer and what opinions I should be voicing. And again, most of those times that is done within the comfort of my own home and surrounded by those that I love and I trust.
Now that is surprising. This is not what I expected you to say at all, because I didn't expect that this would be a struggle for you to have, as you say, this masculine approach to your writing or your role in this fight that you appear to be working towards. This is something that you struggled with. This is something that you were uncomfortable with or even fearful of.
Very much so. What would it be to reflect upon my sex, my station, my family, and to put my husband's good reputation at risk? And of course, ultimately, the cause for which so many of us are fighting for. There's a great risk to be had if people had found out what work had come from my pen.
Now that you're saying this, there's a quote that I read, and I don't know if you wrote this or just somebody said this. You strongly encouraged women writers to be cheerful in their performance of their household duties?
Absolutely.
Tell me what you're thinking about that, because I have a different picture of you. I see you out here like almost like a Sam Adams character where you're stirring things up.
Oh, not like Mr. Adams, sir. Mr. Adams has the luxury of his station and being a male to be able to, as you say, stir things up. No, it is absolutely the job of the wife to run the household and to make sure that she is raising her children in accordance with the laws of God and nature.
Okay, that makes sense. So if that's the case, how do you end up involved in the middle of what is happening right now? Because my understanding is I think the year is 1774, if I've got that right.
It is.
And the ties between England and the colonies are not very good. There are lots of problems. And aren't you having meetings at your house where Sam Adams and all these people are meeting at your home talking about liberty and revolution? Is that not happening at your home in front of you?
Mr. Warren and I have heard our home called One Liberty Square. That is the nickname that has been given to our home in Plymouth. Yes, we are hosting many guests at times. They like to be called committees of correspondence, where we are entertaining friends and like-minded individuals, and many conversations are to be had about what violations of English rights are being committed by our government and what steps need to be taken in order to secure those rights and to restore balance in particularly Massachusetts Bay. Our friends who gather in our parlor, there are many discussions to be had about current events and about what the latest acts from Parliament are saying. And oftentimes, yes, I am invited to take part in these conversations. And it is quite liberating for a woman to be able to speak her mind freely and to share her opinions with those that she respects.
So tell me, at these committees of correspondence, I understand this seems like it was a very significant meeting in relation to what happens next. I listed some names. What people are showing up at these events? I listed some of them, but are there more?
Yes, so Mr. Adams is a frequent visitor. And through Mr. Adams, I have met his delightful wife, Abigail, Mrs. Adams. We have formed a close partnership, she and I, and we write frequently to each other. But other names that you might not know so well of are local individuals from town, from Plymouth and elsewhere. We have friends that come from Barnstable. We have friends that come from Boston and, of course, Braintree, where the Adamses are located. But out of good respect for my friends, I shall not be naming any more names than you currently know, sir.
But is that what is happening at these events? Are we talking about revolution? Are we talking about negotiating with the English? What are your hopes? Is there a possibility of reconciliation?
Sir, you mentioned this word revolution. There are some radicals that are calling for a complete break. However, it is far too early. You might recall just about 2 months ago, December of the last year, that individuals in Boston decided to take it upon themselves and to make a very public statement by destroying 342 chests of tea by dumping them overboard into Boston Harbor. This is a remark against Parliament's repeated acts and abuses against the colonies. And there are some individuals who would be calling for our king, our Lord Sovereign, to be able to take a greater stand, but we have to remind ourselves that this is Parliament and Parliament's actions that have led us to this place currently.
So for somebody that might not understand what you're talking about, what would be the difference between king and Parliament? Are you saying one is to blame and not the other?
You see that Parliament and king are two separate entities. We have our government in England. We also have our government here in the colonies, which has also seemed to have quite lost its way for a number of years now. Our king does not pass the acts and the taxes that Parliament insists on. So if one were to bring their judgment, it would be against Parliament. However, here in Massachusetts, much of our frustration is aimed towards our own local governor and our own colonial assembly. There have been, over the past few years, changes, for example, in the way that our governor and even our courts are paid, which would have been previously determined by our colonial assemblies, and that was used as a measure of a check against the abuse of power, for example. Once that had been violated, and we start to see other acts such as the dreaded Stamp Act of 65, we see the Townshend Acts of 67, and here we are in the year 1774, and many people are fearful of what step Parliament is going to take next in retaliation for the destruction of the tea. So you see, this has been several years of people here in the colonies, specifically in Massachusetts Bay, wondering when will the violation of our rights as English men and women cease. And there does not seem to be an end in sight.
When you say people are fearful, what are they fearful of? Are they fearful that we've got the Stamp Act and we've got the Townshend Act, and now they're going to come out with the Boot and Leather Act, and they're just going to be coming up with new ideas that to tax you, and then you guys fight it back? Or are you thinking bigger things? Like, what do you see happening next?
I think the histories of antiquity have shown us that relatively peaceful spans of time under men's control do not seem to last. Now, the relative peaceful years of my youth, I think, seem to be an anomaly. One of the books that I had read as a child while studying was The History of the World, Raleigh. And knowing that I can combine what I learned from these books and what I've learned from the classics, I use that word fearful because I do believe that we are headed almost headfirst into a period of history where, you use the term revolutionary, that is going to be changing the way that governments and men interact with each other. Are you familiar with the philosopher Locke, for example?
I am somewhat, but please continue.
My dear brother Jemmy and I would sit for hours talking about Mr. Locke's concepts on natural liberties and what agreements the people and the government must have in order for society to function, to proceed. Ms. Adine, tell me in your own mind, what responsibilities and duties does the government have to its people? Or does it?
In our time, I think people would say that government's responsibility, at least the responsibility that they act on, would be to spend money without any intelligent thought, to make poor decisions, and to put politicians in front of us that we don't want to vote for. I think that's what most people would say, but I think what's supposed to happen is I think government is supposed to work together to protect the mass, and then also to do things to make the individual citizen's life better in some way.
I agree. I believe that as these philosophers from Europe are stating, that there is a right for the government and a duty and an obligation to respect the wishes of the people. We can hearken back to Magna Carta, to the English Bill of Rights, where there is a separation and that the crown does not have absolute power over the people. Yet this is what we are seeing happen almost in every single act that has been passed by Parliament against the colonies. And instead of the men and women living here in the colonies being treated as loyal and dutiful subjects of the king, we're being treated as individuals that should be controlled. And so in essence, Mr. Dean, what we're seeing happen here is a breakdown of the rights of English men and women. And so, yes, I am fearful for the future. We are awaiting word of if there is to be retaliation from our government against the destruction of the tea. Some folks have said that they are speculating that more troops will be sent. Some are speculating that even our harbor, our port, could be closed down. And I can't think of more devastating impacts on economy and life and livelihood than if something like that were to happen. It is altogether quite distressing.
So when you say more troops, how many troops are there right now?
It is not necessarily the number, sir. It is the idea that troops should not be quartered or stationed in a town unless it's a time of war. I know of no war. So again, we must ask why these repeated abuses.
It sounds like there's a war against tea right now, and the tea is losing.
You see, we have been boycotting tea for several years now, as well as other imports. Dear friends of mine who share, we should say, common sentiment against our government's policies currently have decided that, yeah, we should not be partaking in tea or importing certain goods. And you shall see this being called out in poetry, in pamphlets, in newspapers.
Speaking of tea, by the way, did the colonists do that? Did Indians do that? Who threw the tea into the bay?
Sir, I am not at liberty to say. I will tell you, I am currently working on a publication, a play, that will allude to the latest unhappy acts in Boston. But yeah. There are individuals who are claiming responsibility, but again, not publicly.
Who are the individuals that are claiming responsibility, but not publicly?
I'm sure you are familiar with a group called the Sons of Liberty.
I am, very much so.
Yes. So members of the Sons of Liberty have decided to take it upon themselves to make a political statement. Now, I'll remind you, good sir, there were other items that were aboard those three ships that were not touched. The only item to be destroyed was tea. And this was in a direct connection to our latest act by Parliament. It was directly a political protest and nothing more. You will see some individuals that tried to spin it as wanton destruction of property. But when you look at a specific item that was targeted, it was tea in direct response. And I have to remind you as well, sir, there were multiple meetings and there were multiple letters sent back and forth of asking that this tea was not going to be unloaded.
Are you saying that there was correspondence with Parliament or the King, or who were you corresponding with saying that we're not going to unload the tea? And were you suggesting that they return the tea to England?
So several times in open discussion to discuss that the tea should not be unloaded from the ships. These decisions are part of a discourse that our government is used to and has the right to engage in. And so when these conversations take place and when there is correspondence that is being published in our newspapers and individuals are talking and discussing about what the fate of the tea should be, one would argue that ample time and opportunity was given before such an act was undertaken.
So they had plenty of warning. And was some of this correspondence between Governor Hutchinson and the people of Massachusetts?
Governor Hutchinson, the name that you bring up.
Did I touch a nerve?
Is a name that I would rather not spend time discussing. You see, Mr. Hutchinson and my family have had quite a history of unpleasant connections. Much of it stems back from my father being passed over in positions of government in favor of Mr. Hutchinson. And of course, my dear elder brother, Jemmy, writing and issuing statements that Mr. Hutchinson did not agree with and currently does not agree with. Mr. Hutchinson has made several decisions in his own time as governor that has not benefited him personally. He has written letters abroad that had been published in our own newspapers that show him to be an enemy of the people of Massachusetts, no matter what he says. And you will see that in some of my political writing, specifically some of my plays, that his character is revealed to be just as it is, which is not favorable in many of the eyes of people here in Massachusetts.
For those that may not be students of history or may not know exactly what Mr. Hutchinson's role was, and you explain that he's doing terrible things and he's not really thinking about the colonies, which is his job. But what is his role? Who is he? Explain who he is.
Mr. Hutchinson's role in government as governor is to be the head of government here in Massachusetts, but also to be listening to his cabinet, to the colonial assembly. And instead, Mr. Hutchinson has made several decisions as his time as governor that has gone against what we feel is within the best interest of the Massachusetts people.
It seems like you obviously have contempt for him, and it seems that he has a very difficult job because what the colonists want and what Parliament and the king want, they're very different. My understanding is the king would just like you to send all their money in the form of taxes and then they'd be happy. And then you'd like to keep all your money and send them none. And so he's trying to be in between the two of you. That seems like a really hard job because it doesn't seem like there's a right answer. Is his job impossible or is he a scoundrel?
These are challenging questions. It perhaps might be a little helpful if I was to give you a more of a history on the background between my family and the Hutchinsons. I mentioned my father lost out on a position in government. It was an unexpected loss. It was thought he was going to win a vote for a place on the governor's council, which is in Massachusetts, have an upper chamber in our legislature. And this is in the House of Representatives. And it was an unexpected loss. Hutchinson, who was then lieutenant governor, was blamed for influencing members to vote against my father. After a few years had passed, Mr. Hutchinson again won a position of a superior court chief justice instead of my father. And I'm fully aware of how it sounds as this might be a personal vendetta, but when you look at the situation in a grander scheme, it is more about a consolidation of power because Mr. Hutchinson, being a member of the governor's council, is also related by marriage to the Oliver family. And the Oliver family and here in Massachusetts, they hold several key government positions. So again, I am fully aware that this sounds as this might be a family matter. However, when you apply it to a grander audience, you can see how members of the government in Massachusetts, when it is so closely connected by family and by blood, the consolidation of power tends to become rather unsettling. And again, it's all about the preservation of liberties of individuals here. He does have a difficult job. However, I think a greater man would understand the implications of his position.
I don't disagree with you at all. I mean, we're obviously aware of what he did, and there's no question he was not the right guy for that job, for sure. Because he just wasn't able, it was a difficult job, but he wasn't able to juggle both duties, in my opinion. And so I guess what I wanted to ask you about him, you were talking about letters that were released, secret letters, and they were published in the papers. Did you have a role in that?
Oh, no, sir. No. These are private letters. And while they had been written several years earlier, this is a new scandal to befall Mr. Hutchinson and Ms. Oliver. When these letters were published, and again, no, none of us are quite certain how these letters were to be found. However, what we do know is that these letters are telling us very much about the content and the character of Mr. Hutchinson. And it is quite unsettling the implications of what he would say about his own people of Massachusetts.
Do you recall the content of any of them?
Well, yeah, they're being published in the newspapers. The implication of these letters are that we are, as a people, are alarmed that our governor and our lieutenant governor would call for the abridgment of our rights, and that there are certain radicals in Massachusetts specifically, and I know that this is specifically relating to my brother, Jemmy, who deserve to suffer the fullest consequences of the law.
Wow. You're saying Jemmy, is that G-E-M-M-Y? Have you spelled it that way? Is that how you're saying it, though?
Yes. Jemmy is the name that I call my eldest brother, James Otis.
I completely understand why you're calling your brother Jemmy. I understand that crystal clear, because there's a lot of Jameses in your life. I mean, what's your brother's actual name is James, right? And your dad and your husband, right?
Yes, sir.
Do you have a child named James?
Yes, sir.
Now, for somebody that is so creative in thought, I'm very surprised that your child's name was James. Everybody's name is James. How do you keep them separated?
Sir, for my eldest son to have the name of not only his father, but also his grandfather and one of the most important people in my life, my eldest brother, it is a badge of honor, sir. Not a lack of creativity, as you would say.
That was an unfair low blow, wasn't it? So we're talking about Hutchinson right now, and my understanding is that you wanted to shine a light on what he was doing and his faults in the hope that, I don't know, maybe somebody would do something different or better. And so there was a play that was a significant piece of literature at that time, and we know about it now. You can get copies of it now.
It is actually quite liberating to be able to talk about this freely. The publication, the Massachusetts Spy, are you familiar with it? It is Mr. Thomas's paper. He ran an advertisement for a performance of a play, The Adulator, at the Grand Parade in Upper Servia. And in his publication, it was certainly not the first page. It was well into his paper, I believe on page 3 or so. He took nearly half a page to list the characters and a couple of scenes from the play, and it caused quite a stir, as you can imagine. Now, this is not going to be an actual play. However, this is going to be released in several parts, and once it was published in the newspapers, then it was able to be printed into a pamphlet. But the character Rapatio, who is Hutchinson, is the individual who is trying to bask in the glory of his scheme, that he was going to be quenching the generous flame, the ardent love of liberty in Servia's freeborn son. And as the title that I chose, The Adulator, he must seek out the adulating tongues of his inner circle to relieve his phantom conscience. I'm quite proud of this publication. Many people were talking about it, and it was really my first step into, again, that masculine realm of politics. That is why I feel now here we are, and I'm about a week, I believe, a week out from giving my first draft to Messrs. Eads and Gill of the Boston Gazette to print my latest poem, which is The Squabble of the Seamen, which is an account of the destruction of the tea. And of course, I have individuals in my life that are championing my writing and encouraging me to continue to put my pen to paper.
Fortunately, we don't have to figure out who those champions are, because they're all the Jameses in your life, right?
They are all the Jameses in my life.
Did you say that it's called The Squabble of the Sea Nymphs?
It is, yes. Or The Sacrifice of the Tuscaroras. It is a fictional account, but I shall give you a little sample. The heroes of the Tuscaroro tribe, who scorned alike a fetter or a bribe, in honor ranged and waited freedom's nod to make an offering to watery god. So essentially, what we have here are the individuals, the sea nymphs, who are going to be partaking in this tea, and the subsequent refusal of the Tuscaroras to do so.
If there's one thing we know about history of sea nymphs, mm-hmm. they love English tea. They just love it. They can't drink enough of it, right?
Well, they should be very happy with the events of the last month or so. This particular idea came from my dear friend, Mr. Adams, who had written to Mr. Warren and had asked if I would take pen to paper and would be able to write a poem in tribute of the Sons of Liberty. And I did not think myself equal to the task asked of me, but my husband reassured me that Mr. Adams would not have just asked anyone to complete a task such as this, and so that I should take it as encouragement and as a privilege.
Especially from John Adams. Talk mm-hmm. about a man who could spin a tale or put it on paper just as easily. That guy can write. For him to ask you to write anything, that would be an honor. Regardless if you were a man or he was a man or whoever was a man or woman, wouldn't make a difference.
Of Mr. Adams, I know him as nothing but encouraging and forward-thinking and thoughtful and pointed. And I believe that it is the last quality that most individuals might take issue with, his pointedness. He is not one to sprinkle seeds of flowers amongst his garden of words. If Mr. Adams has an opinion, he will certainly vocalize it. But it also means that you know where Mr. Adams stands on topics at hand. And there is no guesswork. There's no wondering about what his words mean. And I believe that individuals who are used to speaking in a more gentle and delicate manner, in a way that is more delicate to society's ears, that they take issue with Mr. Adams.
I can't imagine a person having a conversation with him and then John Adams walks away and that person sitting there thinking, I wonder what he was getting at. I'm not sure what he meant. That is probably something that has never happened even one time in his life, even in his own house.
Even in his own house. And my dear friend, Mrs. Adams, Abigail, and I oftentimes remark on the joys and the challenges of marriage and what happens when our husbands voice opinions that perhaps we must have to soften. I believe that Mr. Adams' opponents stoop to levels of insult rather than try to use their own pointed way of speaking with him, which he very much appreciates. And which is why Mrs. Adams is, his equal in every regard.
You have a really good relationship with her, don't you?
We do. Mrs. Adams and I are only recent acquaintances. Mrs. Adams loves to read. And so she and I share that passion. And within our circle of friends, quite often joke and remark on Mrs. Adams' book club. For we will oftentimes read and then in our correspondence write about what we think about the book and our own thoughts and how we would most likely intrigue the works of literature. So it is quite amusing, our correspondence with one another.
Are there female writers in your time that do publish under their name? Are there any?
Oh, there are. Again, most of this is going to be poetry or works for the gentler sex. There is a publication that is printed in London called The Ladies Magazine. And in these publications, oftentimes you'll have short stories and you will have music and you will have recipes and you will have poetical works. And of course, foreign and domestic news from abroad. And oftentimes we will be reading works that are written by women for women. In our own colony of Massachusetts, there have been women who have written. There is currently a woman who is writing and is publishing. And would you believe she is an enslaved woman in Boston? Her name is Mrs. Wheatley. And though I have not had the chance to meet Mrs. Wheatley, her works are being published under her own name.
And she's an enslaved woman.
She is.
I love books, and I hear you talking, I love reading, and I love, mm-hmm. as I hear you talking about Mrs. Adams and you being in Abigail Adams' book club, that sounds like a lot of fun, because she is spirited in a different way than John Adams is, a way that is a little easier to swallow, so to speak. Is that where your education started? I mean, your ability to write the way you do, your ability to engage in these political discussions that ordinarily, as you say, would be considered masculine? Did that come from books? Did you have some formal education?
It is said that there are certain smells that can bring instant comfort or trigger the most unpleasant memories. Do you know what I speak of?
I think I do, yes.
How scent can bring comfort. For me, it's the scent of paper and leather and ink. There is no greater joy than if I was to walk into a bookstore, print shop, or a library and sit in silence with a book in my hand. And it has been books that are my constant companion over the years during James's absence. The letters, again, I mentioned in correspondence to my dear friends and family. It's paper and it's the quill. My dear husband oftentimes refers to me as the scribbler. That's one of his terms of affection for me. At our home in Plymouth, there is a little desk in front of a window in the upstairs of our house where I frequently enjoy sitting and casting my gaze out the window and writing. And you might think I'm a silly woman for saying so, but I believe there's something cathartic in putting words from the mind down onto paper and then releasing those words wild into the world. From my earliest year, books and discourse about books have brought me joy. My brother, Demi, and my brother, Joseph, as with custom, were given the privilege of studying in tutelage under Reverend Russell, who happens to be our uncle, in Barnstable. And much of this push for education came from my father. You see, my father was not a learned man, and I believe that this was insecurity that he held on to for most of his life. And he was very insistent upon Jemmy and Joseph receiving a formal education. Now, Joseph did not take to books and learning the way that Jemmy did. And I'm sure at some point, concerning to my father, and Joseph went to work in my father's store, it is because of Joseph's reluctance to sit and to learn that I believe I was given the opportunity to sit in on my brother's lessons with Reverend Russell. When you walked into Reverend Russell's study, Mr. Dean, I would estimate that there were 100 books in that study. And so again, that smell really brings me back to my childhood. And I had begged and begged Papa that I could sit in on these lessons. And once Joseph vacated his studies, I would sit in awe and listen to how my brother would speak with Reverend Russell about the topics that were at hand. We'd be reading classics and histories, the translations of Virgil and Homer. I wasn't allowed to learn Latin and Greek, but I could listen in and I would listen to the sermons from Reverend Russell. I'd be able to write. And I believe this is where really my love for the classics and for any allusions that I can make to antiquity in my writing comes from. I'm sorry. My memories are taking me to a place that you must just think I'm so silly for. I apologize.
I do not think that at all. I literally am like sitting on the edge of my seat on every word that you're saying, because I think that what it takes for somebody in your time to rise to this level is extraordinary. I mean, you just described to me that your brother is sitting there in class and you're waiting for him to get done with his lesson so that you can pick up the scraps, so to speak. Like, you can do some studying, you can do some learning, and you're just patiently waiting for your turn to learn. I mean, is that what you just described?
Yes, and I was included in these lessons as a young girl. And when my brother went to college and was at the college age, he went to Harvard, he would come home and I would sit at his feet and just listen to him discuss, again, what he felt was the role and responsibility of government. And he would tell me his beliefs and he would ask me mine. And this relationship that was cultivated over the love of books and for learning was really, I believe, where my drive to want to take up the pen in honor of my brother stems from.
It stems from seeing him as a role model in your life.
At this current moment, my brother is unable,
It's okay.
My brother is unable to continue work in promoting the liberties of us here in the colonies.
Now I hate to ask, but I don't know what happened to your brother. Why is that?
It is quite challenging for me to discuss. My brother always pursued everything that he did in life with passion. From a very young age, had just a wonderful way with mastering the English language, where he could take an argument of the most mundane nature and be able to convince you of how splendid it was with just the turn of a few phrases. My brother also, with this passion, suffered from what I frequently like to call his storm. There were times when my brother's emotions could be unpredictable. And there were times growing up where we would, as a family, be in a very pleasant setting and everything seemed to be very positive. And it almost seemed as within an instant, my brother's demeanor would shift and the storms would cloud his eyes and he would be taken to fits. And as someone who loved my brother, Mr. Adams sometimes would on occasion call my brother Sir Bluster Esquire for the unpredictable nature of my brother's temper. And this oftentimes could get my brother into difficult situations. Now, Mr. Dean, you must understand that my brother is the sole reason why we here in Massachusetts Bay are able to continue the work toward writing these works that are going to be hopefully changing the way that Parliament interacts and sees us as subjects. Very early on, my brother wrote about his argument against the writs of assistance, which were a horrific idea from Parliament that allowed government officials to come into your private residence or to board your private property and to search and seize suspicious goods.
That sounds crazy.
My brother went on to write that taxation without representation is tyranny. It is because of my brother and his brilliant mind and his way with words. It is because of him that I am able to take my first steps into the political realm. And because of his passion, he frequently would run afoul of individuals who did not share his opinion, who did not believe that he should be voicing his opinion the way that he does. And one instance, there was an individual, a scoundrel named Mr. Robinson, who set upon my brother and beat him mercilessly with the cane.
Mercy had an extraordinary ability to insert herself into the middle of Massachusetts politics without overstepping what the public expected of a woman in her time. Yet, Mercy had something to say, and she was going to find a way to be heard. In the next episode, Mercy will answer all kinds of tough questions, including, what would you do different if you were a man and didn't have the restraints that society puts on you as a woman? Mercy will also talk about John Hancock as she rolls her eyes a little bit before informing us that everyone knows Mr. Hancock. I'm glad you're enjoying the podcast. If you haven't yet, subscribe now, and we'll see you at the next episode of the Calling History Podcast with part 2 of Mercy Otis Moreland.